Welcome to AFSPA Talks, a production of the American Foreign Service Protective Association with Chief Operating Officer Kyle Longton. Be sure to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast channel. Enjoy the episode.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of AFSPA Talks. I'm Kyle Longton. Today, we continue our month-long focus on infertility and family formation. We're going to focus on the second part of that theme. So today, AFSPA talks about family formation journeys. This episode is the first one I envisioned when we started planning the theme for this month, finding guests and so forth for some of our other episodes and even for our live event at first. We're a bit of a challenge, but we're lucky we had partners who came together for this. But I'm glad that with the help of our friends at Glypha, we were able to combine this discussion about family formation with another important theme for the month of June, which is Pride Month. So today you'll hear three conversations with members of the Foreign Service community. Each family has grown in its own way over the last decade, actually. My hope is that, like me, you will learn something about the options for family formation, the ups and downs of each, and celebrate the family in your life, however it is formed. In the first interview, I talk with Brandon and Adonis about their experience adopting a child. They discuss their experience working with an agency and how their life changed very quickly when they found out their baby was on its way. As a same-sex couple, they also share some of the challenges they experienced following their child's birth. Next, Emily and her wife began the process of growing their family about a decade ago. Emily shares their two-year-long experience with IUI and IVF, the support they had from their friends and community, and how she and her wife were able to work with their employer to manage overseas assignments, leave, and more. She also talks about their experiences. Their daughter was born about 8 years ago. Finally, Robbie joins me to share the years-long journey he and his husband have been on to grow their family. He talks about saving for surrogacy and IVF early in his career and even before he met his husband, their early discussions about the future of their family, the embryo creation process, the surrogate selection process, and experience with miscarriage, and then, just when things seem to be turning around, the intervention of COVID to stall, but thankfully not derail their family formation plans. This is going to be one of our longer episodes, but with good reason. I hope that you will hang in there and listen to all the conversations about family formation. Each story is inspiring, and I'm so grateful to our guests for sharing their experiences with us. But before we get started with those conversations, I want to remind you to mark your calendar for 11 a.m. Eastern Time on Thursday, June 30th. AFSPA Live will continue these conversations and feature guests who have gone through IVF in their own lives. We'll be able to answer your questions about the experience and from their perspective, and talk about some possible changes to the coverage for family formation within the Foreign Service Benefit Plan. So without further ado, I'm happy to bring these stories about families in the Foreign Service community to you. Thank you all so much for joining me today. I'll ask you, would you mind introducing yourselves?
Sure. My name is Brandon Thompson. I'm a Foreign Service Officer with the Department of State.
And my name is Adonis Borges. I am a curriculum developer at the Department of State as well.
Excellent. And how long have you all been together?
We met in 2011.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we got married in 2013.
Yeah, so it's been a while.
Yeah. We never had our big party. We kept putting that off. So
there's still time. Still time. You've got the 10-year anniversary coming up next year, right?
Yes.
That's true. Yeah, we're planning a party for that. We'll see.
Yeah.
I just celebrated 10 years with my spouse, and we celebrated with a bottle of champagne and some homemade turkey burgers.
So. I think that's the best way to do it, honestly, after funny. You start looking at the prices for venues and all that kind of stuff.
That's crazy.
It's true. Yep. And then considering childcare for the night, having to pay for that too.
Yep.
Well, I appreciate you all being willing to share your story about your family, and particular how you all, after the two of you came together, how you all went about expanding your family. So when did you all first decide to expand your family to include a child? Was that something you'd been planning for, or did it come together after a couple years of marriage?
After a bit of marriage, yeah, we, like I said, we met in 2011, and we really, I mean, it was something in the back of our heads for a while, but we didn't really get serious about it until 2020. Had no relation to the pandemic, but that was just when we started having the conversation.
Yeah, especially because Brandon was in Washington and he's a Foreign Service officer. We have to move to different places. And we thought it would be easier to start the process here in the U.S. Compared to other countries.
That makes a lot of sense.
It was just the perfect time to do that.
Yeah, I had just gotten back from Kabul. So we had done 1 year apart.
Yeah.
It was really hard, but we made it through that year. And I think, you know, we felt like after making it through 1 year apart and, you know, being in Kabul of all places, that if we could make that work, we could make anything work.
So. I think that's a fair assessment. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, we started the conversation like early 2020, and pretty soon after we had decided, you know, let's not do a celebration now. We had thought, you know, maybe we'll have like a 10 year since we got together in 2011, plan for 2021. No, we decided not to. Let's put all that effort into expanding our family.
Yeah. But we always wanted to have a kid. It was just about knowing the right moment.
Timing. Yeah.
Yeah, especially if it had happened before Kabul, Adonis, that would have been a lot on you for a year.
Yeah. I know
that wasn't an unaccompanied post for sure.
Yeah, the dog was already my responsibility.
Yeah, and it
was
I a felt lot bad of a, enough leaving just with the dog.
Imagine a baby. Yeah.
Well, when you all thought about expanding your family, you what options did you consider? Did you think about surrogacy? Was it just adoption? And how did you go through that process?
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, we were very open to everything. So we were really looking into all options. You know, even I had friends that had like offered over the years to, you know, donate eggs or help us in any way. And just, I mean, after looking through the different options, we decided that probably adoption was the best way. It took us a lot longer to decide if we were going to do international or domestic, but I think we pretty quickly turned from surrogacy or like IVF to adoption. It just, it's something that I think resonated more with us than anything else. So.
Okay.
But like I said, it was more for us, an issue of international versus domestic.
Okay.
We really wanted to adopt from Brazil because Adonis is from Brazil. And I had spent many years down there. So we started looking into the process there.
Yeah, but internationally, they only do older kids. And we really wanted a baby. Because the line in Brazil is already so big that they don't want to send babies abroad.
Mm-hmm. There's very few agencies that work with international adoptions to Brazil in the United States to begin with. And we talked with one of them, and it sounded very complicated. So we looked even at other options, but I think just in general, international adoptions have become much more complicated than they used to be. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we started researching about domestic, and it seems to be much better fit for us, especially because we were both in the United States, we were planning to be here for a while, that the timing just seemed to look like it was going to work for us.
Okay, that's great. And did you all work through, I think you mentioned when we spoke before, you'd work through an agency essentially to help find the birth family and pair you up. Can you talk a little bit about what that process was like for you all?
Yeah, it's a nationwide agency. Can I say the name of the agency?
Yeah, I'm fine with that. Yeah. Yeah,
it's called American Adoptions, and they work with the whole country. And this makes things easier because you have access to all the different states. There are many agencies that are only based in one specific state, and usually the wait's longer if you do that. However, you have to pay a little bit more if you want to use a nationwide agency mm-hmm. for adoptions, but we decided to go that route because we didn't have a lot of time here.
Yeah. I mean, like just knowing that our time was limited, we were looking for a faster option. And I think actually because of the pandemic, some of the smaller agencies' wait times had just really blown out of proportion. So we did talk to a few agencies here in the DC, Virginia, Maryland area. And yeah, they were saying, you know, several years before we could even start the process. Whereas with American Adoptions, they're based in Kansas City, okay. But they do have a nationwide spread. So just because of that, they have their wait time is much quicker.
Okay. And so how quickly did the process go from when you first started working with them to when you were to match with a birth family and before your child came to join your family?
It was actually pretty quick. We were not expecting.
Yeah.
Because this is a decision that comes from the mother. They see a profile of your family and they decide if they think you are the right match for them. Okay. And only after 3 months since we had started the process, we got a call saying, we have a baby for you. It's a boy. And we're like, oh my God, we were not expecting for that that fast.
So was that baby is born or baby's coming soon? What was
coming soon?
It was like in a few weeks. We didn't even have a month. Yeah.
And we hadn't purchased anything. We didn't have anything. We're just like, oh my goodness, happening.
Yeah. So, I mean, we had to go through the home study and all of that process. There's a lot of background check and all of that. So that took probably like, I don't know, 6 months, something like that. But after our profile went live on the website, Adonis said it was like 3 months before we got, and it was our first match. I know some people get matched and things don't work out, but it was our first match. And we were told, she's due in a few weeks. So,
So then we started rushing like crazy to get everything ready.
Yeah. It was a mad rush.
Yes.
The nice thing is, you know, babies can sleep in a box for the first couple of weeks if they need
that's
to.
True.
You know, that's what they do in Scandinavia. So,
well, we looked at the box. The great thing was that my sister had just given birth a few months earlier. Mm-hmm. So we were able to kind of use a lot of hand-me-downs and things that she had just grown out of. And my other sister has a 3-year-old. So those other things we could also use. So we got really lucky with all the family donations.
Yeah, it's true.
Good. And so you had, is your family nearby? Did you have support from them sort of from the time you brought your son home?
I mean, unfortunately, Adonis's family is in Brazil, and so they still haven't met. We just bought our tickets for Brazil this summer.
Fortunately, they are in Brazil.
Yeah.
So well, we have an excuse to go.
Yeah. I mean,
we need to edit that part out there, Adonis.
But it's really sad that his family hasn't been able to meet.
Yeah, because of COVID. You don't want to travel with a newborn, you know.
Yeah,
we had to go through that. Now we feel a little bit more comfortable mm-hmm. to go there.
Yeah, but my family is all within like a 6-hour radius. Okay. So, I mean, not too far. And we were able to pick up things and, have that, have those items ready for the baby. But I mean, the big thing was we were living in a 1-bedroom apartment
in DC.
Downtown DC. with a dog and no, I mean, definitely no crib or, you know, any place to put the crib. So it was
pretty tough.
It was, you know, what are we going to do now? Even if we get donated things, where are we going to put the baby?
Now we are in the suburbs. We had to give up DC because it was just too much.
Yeah.
What do you define as suburbs?
So we're in Arlington.
I mean, all right, good. We're on the same page. That was my definition of suburbs also. I now live in Poolsville, so be careful. It's in Western Montgomery County. The definition stretches over time.
That's true.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. But I mean, we were just so ecstatic when we heard the news, and we didn't care. You know, we could put the baby in a box, but we were going to get the baby. Yeah. So. There was no question when the agency called and said, you know, there's this possible match. Are you interested? We just
were like, of course.
There was not even a pause. We're like, yes, yes.
Well, and you mentioned that you're in an open adoption with your son's birth mother. What's that like? How does that work?
Yeah, it was something new to us when we, you know, were starting the adoption process. We didn't really know that much about it. I mean, kind of like when I was growing up, I had a few friends that found out when they were in their teens that they were adopted and really had no contact with their birth family at all. And so this is kind of like the new process that's better for the child and better for everybody, really. And so when it was explained to us that, you know, the birth mother wanted to play a role in our son's life, and, you know, maintain contact. Of course, we were nervous because this is, you know, another person that we don't know, a stranger that we're now bringing into our family. But when we were explained that, you know, this is for the best interest of him, then, you know, it just made sense. And we got to meet her. I mean, she was wonderful. She let Adonis cut the cord, actually. We were not in the room, but right next to the room. And
yeah,
we were basically there from the very beginning. And, you know, it basically means that we've just been exchanging emails. We've agreed to, you know, meet up throughout his life and just explain to him that, you know, this is where he came from and that this is, you know, another important person in his life.
So. Okay. That's excellent. Yeah. I've been reading that's sort of been the shift in recent years, to tell that story from the very beginning and it's a bigger group of people, more love available, to him. Absolutely.
Yeah. It wasn't easy at the beginning just because we weren't sure how she was going to react. And, you know, we were really nervous that maybe she would change her mind. I mean, even after he was born, we had to stay out there for a bit, just for some of the paperwork to go through. And I mean, she invited us over to her house and we were very nervous of, you know, like, is she having second thoughts and all this type of thing. But I mean, it was very clear that she had made up her mind and she was just, you know, wanting to be a part of his life from the beginning too. So.
Okay. All right. Well, if anybody is listening or watching and is thinking about adoption, do you have any, you've shared your experience and there's great information out there, but do you have any other advice or points that you might tell them to consider as they're going through that process?
I think going for the nationwide company, if you want things to go faster, is important because we heard that in DC it's taking many years for many parents. The wait's so long, so it's definitely a factor to consider.
I mean, I think another important aspect of adoption that we didn't really talk on yet is, you know, they request you to be very open-minded and, you know, that's also something that you have to consider, you know, with potential drug use from the mother, or exposure, you know, issues of domestic violence, even down to like, you know, adopting a child of a different race. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these things are issues that, you know, perhaps other routes you don't have to consider, but they really are important, for, you know, the couple to have really serious conversations about and be sure that, you know, whatever you're matched with,
yeah,
that you're going to accept that child for who he or she is. And I think just for our case, you know, it went very fast, but I think just patience. I mean, even those 3 months and then those 3 weeks that we had to wait, it was, you know, nerve wracking. I mean, I can't imagine having to wait years. But that is a possibility when, yeah, you're adopting, yeah, that the time frame is never certain. So
yeah, and be ready for the questions that people ask. Like, that's even nowadays, many people ask, because our son is a red hair. None of us have red hair. And all the time I get questions like, oh, is your wife red hair?
Yeah.
And I'm like, not really.
Even in our doctor's office, we've got those type of questions.
Sometimes people are like, oh, he looks like you. I was like, are you sure? That's, okay.
That's a really frequent question.
Yeah, yeah. People, they just...
I think it's like an automatic, like...
Yeah, they just associate.
People, it's just a question that something that people just say all the time, you looks like you, and it's just like, yeah. Oh, well, that's interesting.
Well, and if you've got a few more words, I want to ask a couple questions if I can. Did you all encounter any barriers because you are a same-sex couple?
Well, I mean, I think, and actually the adoption agency told us this, that we might have a faster matching just because some biological mothers feel more comfortable when there's not another woman in there. I don't know if that's true or not.
Yeah.
But that was something that kind of seemed to work to our benefit.
But he was born in a conservative state. And we felt some reactions for the people who work at the hospital, yeah, where he was born. Yeah. Certain nurses were not happy that was happening.
Yeah.
And they, I remember one of the nurses tried to convince the mother to change her mind.
In front of us.
Yes. Yeah. This happened, yeah, in the hospital.
Wow.
The social worker really mistreated us there.
Yeah.
I don't know. It was just... You could feel the atmosphere, how,
I mean,
some people were not happy with what was happening there.
Yeah.
Conversely, from how well we were treated by the biological mother. Yeah.
And the adoption company.
And the adoption company. There was a lot of stigma we felt in the hospital.
Yeah.
And that was really tough. Those first 48 hours, you know, before the birth mom, you know, signed the documents. Those were really nerve-wracking because we weren't feeling very supported from the hospital, and, you know, actually had a few people that were actively trying to persuade her to change her mind.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was tough. And I mean, since then, you know, being back in DC, I think it's more like those subtle things that people don't think about. Like we said, like, oh, you know, is your wife a redhead, or he looks like you? So I think those kind of like subtle things, but they do impact you for sure.
Yeah.
And I mean, even like family that have the best intentions, you know, they say things like, well, oh, he's the look at that nice red hair. He's going to get all the girls' attention, you know. Very like these type of things too, that you just,
yeah,
have to be patient with, or boys or both, or who knows.
Well, yeah. Right.
Yeah. We breathe. Okay.
Yeah. Cool. I think also being two men, we get a lot of
lectures.
Yeah. Like, oh, you shouldn't do this that way. You know?
Yeah.
This is, you know, like,
one time we were walking on the street and this random woman put sunscreen on his face.
Yeah, like in like 5 seconds. I was like,
yeah. And I was like, did I ask you for sunscreen?
She's like, oh, you have to put sunscreen on that baby. Did you not? And I'm like, well, you need to ask me first.
Wow.
I mean, super early in the morning, like there was no sun.
I mean, just like the kind of unwelcome advice.
Well, and the general assumption that men are going to be incompetent at anything to do with children.
I mean, hey, I think we can use some advice, but I think anybody when they had their first baby can use advice.
Absolutely.
It's a bit much.
This probably goes beyond adoption. Even like a straight guy walking with his kid might happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or I still have my members of my family when I'm home with the kids. Oh, you're babysitting. No, I'm parenting, actually. But sure.
Yeah. Oh, gosh.
Oh, well, thank you all so much. I so appreciate you sharing your story and your family's story with me. Can I ask how old is your son now?
Well, he just turned one.
Yeah. Wow. One year, 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just had our big 1 year celebration for him.
And the classic smash with the cake or cupcake. Excellent. Excellent.
Yeah. So yeah, it was a celebration for us too. There was some champagne for the dads.
Good.
We made it through the first year.
I'm glad. Well, thank you all very much, Brandon and Adonis. I really appreciate you all sharing your story with us and sharing some advice with anybody else who might be considering adoption and going that route. This has meant a lot to us. So thank you.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity to share a story. Really appreciate it.
Emily Tykinson, welcome to Ask the Talks. Thank you for joining us today. I'm wondering if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about yourself and your wife.
Sure. So my name is Emily Tykinson. I'm currently the consular chief in Bratislava, Slovakia. I joined the State Department in May of 2013 and also served in Sao Paulo, Brazil and Kyiv, Ukraine before coming to Slovakia. I'm here with my wife, who I met in the Peace Corps in Ukraine in 2005. She worked for a little over 11 years for USAID as a PSC, both in Washington before I joined the State Department. And then she was teleworking from wherever I was posted for many years as well. And then now just moved recently to a new job at an international organization where she continues to telework from Slovakia, and then hopefully wherever we will be posted in the future. We have an 8-year-old daughter named Maya, and she is just finishing second grade. She goes to the British school here in Slovakia, and when we lived in Ukraine prior to this, she went to local Ukrainian state preschool. She learned to speak Russian very well and continues to speak Russian. We have a Ukrainian nanny here with whom she speaks Russian still every day. So that's a little bit about us.
That's wonderful. So I want to back up to you and now your wife met in the Peace Corps in 2005. And have you all been together since then?
So we actually, I would say we didn't really get together until towards the end of our Peace Corps service in 2007. And then I think, you know, Peace Corps is kind of a weird time, especially when you're finishing and there's a lot of transition. So I think we officially have been together maybe since early 2008. And kind of after Peace Corps was more official, we like to say. And then we then went to grad school together in New York at the same university, just kind of serendipitously stayed together there, and then got married soon after I graduated. She was a little bit ahead of me, stayed in New York while I finished. And then we got married and moved to Washington.
All right. And you said you started I'm doing the math here. You said your daughter's 8. So I'm backing up. And then you started with the State Department in 2013. So it sounds like the 2013, 2014 was a busy time in your life. But I'm curious, for you and your wife, was having a child and growing your family in that way always part of the plans? Was it something that sort of came about after you moved to Washington? What was your all's process there?
Yeah, I'm not sure if we ever had a long, serious discussion about whether we wanted to have kids or not. I think we always just knew that we wanted to be moms. We definitely, obviously, you have to sort of have a discussion about how you're going to make it happen when you're a two-mom family or prospective two-mom family. But I think that was always kind of part of the plan. And then when we moved to Washington in 2010, we heard about an organization called Rainbow Families that's based in Washington, and they have a class called Maybe Baby that they run. At that time, I think it was twice a year for two 12-week sessions. And so I think it was in 2011, later in 2011, we signed up to take this class, and every Sunday for 12 weeks, we went up to Silver Spring and hung out in a room of some organization that had volunteered the space, and spoke with a bunch of other two mom family couples, or I guess LGBT, some of it was LGBT mixed couples, and for some of it, they would separate sort of men and women couples, and some of the issues are different. And then kind of discussed options and heard from other parents about all of their experiences and how they created their families, and everything from kind of the science to it, to the logistics of it, to some, you know, families were living in group LGBT group homes in Washington, and all the different ways you can sort of make it work and build your own family through kind of untraditional means. So that was really helpful for us in sort of kind of deciding how we wanted to create our family. And then I think soon after that, we went to see a reproductive endocrinologist who had come to our Maybe Baby class, who works with a lot of LGBT couples in Washington, and decided that we would try for one of us to carry with a known donor. And so we decided to go down that path. I think we did consider, we looked at adoption for a few minutes, I want to say, but at that time we were already kind of down the Foreign Service path. We hadn't joined yet, but we were sort of going down the path of joining. And we knew that we would need to be in Washington for a long time to do domestic adoption, just because the process takes a long time with the home studies, and getting assigned a family can take years in some cases. So we thought that would maybe be not the best choice for us if we wanted to join the Foreign Service at that time. And then there weren't any countries in the world then that were working with LGBT couples on international adoption. So having our own kind of biological child seemed to make the most sense.
Okay. And so you made the decision that adoption wasn't right for you. So you looked at artificial reproductive options. The ART procedures, as it, at least we call it in my community with the payers and the medical side. What was that process like?
Yeah, so I think so for us, I think we went kind of the traditional route of the two mom family, where one mom, you know, decides to sort of carry, and then you have to decide about your donor situation. And for us, we were thinking about anonymous donation versus known donors. And I'm really lucky that I have a brother who is also gay and who I'm really close to. And we decided to ask him if he would potentially be our donor. And then my wife, Jessie, would carry. And fortunately, he said that he would be happy to be our donor. And so at that point, we were so excited about this idea of having a baby who was biologically related to us that we really, to both of us, that we really were committed to making this work. And so we went through, I would say, so I guess 2 years, almost two full years of IUIs and then two rounds of IVF. And we had lots of failed attempts through these 2 years, and it was a very long, arduous, extremely expensive process. I feel like we're still sort of recovering financially from it, even this much later. Yeah. But there was never a time when we thought, maybe we'll just try a different donor. That was just not something that we wanted to consider. And so I think we really We invested probably more time and money and heartache into making it work with my brother as the donor. And then fortunately it did. The second IVF was successful. We got 5 embryos. We put 2 back and one of them stuck. It became Maya. So that's great. And then we put the other 3 in the freezer. And then about 18 months later, we started to try to have a second child with those 3 frozen embryos. And unfortunately, none of those worked. So then we decided, okay, I think that's the sign that it's time for us to just be done as a family of 3. And that's been good. So we're happy that the original plan ended up working, even though it took a very, very long time.
Yeah. And you mentioned the financial aspect, and I think that's well known to anybody who's thinking about this process, has gone through it, or even who hasn't, that this is expensive. But so you mentioned the financial aspect and still recovering from that some years later. And I think that aspect is well known to anybody who's been through this process and even those who haven't. But you also mentioned a lot of heartache over those 2 years. And as you switched from IUI and then to IVF and multiple attempts that didn't work out. And I'm wondering if you're willing to share a little bit more about how that affected you and your wife and your relationship.
Sure. Yeah, it was a really hard time. I think one of the hardest things is just that it was, I mean, obviously very expensive. So I think the IUIs were costing us a couple thousand dollars initially. And then as you increase the kind of medications you're using, they get more expensive. All in all, we spent more than $50,000 just on our first pregnancy. And then we spent another 25-ish trying to have a second child before we decided that we were done. So that is just a lot of money in a kind of a very short time frame. Yeah. I think the $50,000 we spent was in, you know, less than 2 years. So that was a lot of money. So one, you don't have a lot of money for doing a lot of other things in your life, but also you don't really have time to do a lot of other things in your life because you're just constantly going to the doctor and timing your cycles. You know, we would try to make some plans on weekends and then all of a sudden, nope, I have to cancel them because it's time to go for another check at the doctor. We could never go on any vacations or trips because we never knew when we had to be away. I remember there was even 1 year and we were determined to go to Pride in DC with some friends, but we also had to have the timing of trigger shot, as they call it, during the IVF at a, you know, very specific time. And so we had our friends come help us with this trigger shot as we were, you know, walking out the door to Pride and trying to catch up with everyone. We even did, you know, some injections. I remember once, like in the bathroom at some sort of Glypha happy hour once, just like in the stall in one bathroom, we have to run out to use the bathroom. And we're like doing shots, not the fun kind of shots, but, you know, medical shots during happy hour. So our whole life basically revolved around this medical process for a couple years. And so that kind of, it does really, you know, take a toll. And then obviously every month you sort of get your hopes up and then it doesn't work out. So it's sad. And I think it was, you know, obviously the most heartbreak occurred during the first IVF when, you know, you go through the IVF process and that is really expensive and time consuming and there's a lot of medication. And then we ended up getting some embryos and they were sort of like growing in the incubator for several days. And then as we were going to go to the transfer where they sort of put them back, our doctor called to say that they had all sort of just disintegrated for some reason overnight, just like very suddenly, which doesn't happen very frequently, I guess. So that was, of course, really devastating. And then we were already in A100 at that point and trying to decide what we were going to, you know, where we were going to be living. We weren't even sure if we'd be able to do another cycle before we would be moving again. And then fortunately, the CDOs were fairly understanding. And so they said, okay, you can go into language for your first assignment. And so our bidding strategy was basically just where can we go into long-term training so that we'll be able to be here for at least another round of IVF, if not 2, depending on how long it was going to take. So fortunately, that did all work out. The second round, a few months later, it did work, and we were able to to be in Washington for that time. But I know other couples have had similar stresses where CDOs have been less accommodating, and it has been really difficult to sort of either transfer your IVF process to another country, if that's even a possibility for wherever you're living, or to try to fly back. And when we were making our trying to make the second child, which ultimately didn't work out, we were living in Ukraine at the time, and my wife was sort of, she was doing blood work locally at a Ukrainian clinic and sending it back to Washington, and then she was flying back to Washington kind of on a moment's notice on the right day to do the transfers. And so obviously that was also very expensive and stressful, not the best way that you want to do IVF, but yes, it's sort of, I think, what you have to do in the Foreign Service to make some of these things work.
Yeah. And you mentioned even when it came time for your wife to deliver, Maya, there was a challenge in terms of registering birth abroad. And so there was travel back at that point as well. But I think you also said you had some support from your supervisor at that time as well.
So we were hoping, because we were assigned to Sao Paulo, and most people who are assigned to Sao Paulo and have a baby during their tour just give birth locally. The healthcare is really good. The hospital in Sao Paulo is excellent. And so we were sort of hoping to do the same thing, particularly because we would be, or the baby was going to be due within a couple months of arrival. So it would be, it's difficult to sort of arrive and then turn right back around again to go on leave. But we sort of had asked, pre-asked the department whether my wife would be able to be on the birth search on the CRIBA. So we knew that she wouldn't be able to be allowed. We knew that she wouldn't be allowed to be on the birth certificate in Brazil. Brazil actually is fairly progressive, I think, for LGBT rights, in that they allow second parent adoptions after children are born. So for couples who are giving birth locally in Brazil, generally the biological, or the birth mother, I guess, is on the birth certificate, and then the second parent, regardless of sex, can adopt the child and then be added to the birth certificate. But because we were going to be there on diplomatic status, we also wouldn't have been allowed to use the legal system. So that would not have been an option for us. And then since I wouldn't have been on the original birth certificate, the department would not have added me to the CRIBA at that time, even though we were already married, and even though I even had a pre-birth order naming me as a second parent. They said, no, that wouldn't be possible. I know the guidance has, I think, changed since then. So I think that it is more possible now for same-sex couples to be on the CRIBA, even in cases, in certain cases where they're not on the local birth certificate. So that's great. But at the time, that wasn't going to work for us. So then we decided to go to Medevac back to Washington. We were in PCS housing, and we chose to live in Roslyn because at that time, Virginia wasn't allowing the same-sex parents on birth certificates either. And so we thought, okay, well, if we're in Roslyn and there's an emergency, we can at least run across the bridge into Georgetown, and yep, then we'll be in Washington, call the ambulance from there, and then we can go to a hospital in Washington, and then we'll both be on the birth certificate. But there was a little bit of worry, I think, when we were in Arlington, wherever we were out around in Virginia during that time, that there'd be an emergency where the baby would, you know, be born in Virginia, and then we probably would have had to curtail, because I would have had to then go through a long legal process in Virginia to be able to adopt the baby before I would have been able to go back to post, which would have just been, you know, half my tour. And at that point, it's just kind of, you know, what's the point? So there were a lot of stresses, I think. Fortunately, again, now in Virginia, you also can be added to your child's birth certificate at birth if you're a same-sex parent. So fewer challenges than now than we had even just 8 years ago. But yeah, at the time, it was a lot of things to consider.
I can't imagine going through all that and likely figuring it out on your own, or at least from experiences maybe others shared, and doing it from Brazil as well. So that, I mean, it's inspiring in a way. It's also very frustrating that you had to go through this, and but I'm glad it worked out for you all. I just, before we wrap up, I want to ask, do you have any advice for somebody who's listening to this and is considering IUI, IVF, any kind of art procedure as part of their family formation journey.
Yeah, so I was talking with some friends recently, and it does sound like some of the insurance plans, or maybe depending on the state you're living in the Washington area, do have more coverage for IUI and IUS services, or at least some of the monitoring and procedures associated with them than when we were going through the process. So I would definitely encourage everyone to look at your insurance options very carefully. And then even potentially, you know, switch insurance plans to the one that's that offers the most coverage for your situation. That'd probably be my number one recommendation, just because the finances, you think you're going into, oh, it's a couple thousand dollars here, a couple thousand dollars there, and then all of a sudden it can be 2 years later and you're out $70,000. So looking at the finances early on, it would be really helpful. And then also, I mean, everyone says this about everything regarding the Foreign Service and anything related to HR, but, you know, advocate for yourself. You know, we really pushed our CDOs, we pushed the department on so many issues and, you know, pieces of our plan and what was going to work for us and what wasn't, and just made it really clear, you know, in a way that made sense both for us and also for the department. You know, we're trying to, you know, frame it as not just only thinking about what makes sense, the most sense for our family, but, you know, how the department can help us so that we are the department can be as well. So. So yeah, just advocate, and then join GLIFA. There's lots of people who've gone through this process in GLIFA, who've created their families in every possible way, and everyone's always really helpful and willing to share. And we also, yeah, couldn't have done a lot of what we did without their advocacy and help, and continue to do. Or to reach out to them regularly for help as needed to.
Good. And it sounds like from some of the things you said earlier also that you really relied on your friends and others in the community for support. And you're talking about going out, you know, having shots, not the fun kind, but literal shots for your wife in a bar, or maybe on the way out to Pride celebration, things like that. Like, people knew about it. You were able to share those experiences as much as possible with other people and rely on them, and through GLIFA as well with others who've gone through the similar journey. And that sounds like that was helpful.
Yes, definitely. I think for us, being really vocal and open about the entire process, it worked in our benefit. And I completely understand people who don't want to be so open about their trying to conceive journey, especially because it's just so emotional at the time. But for us, we found it more helpful and more supportive when we could just say, hey, this is what we're doing. Like, all of our friends and family sort of knew every step. I started sort of, you know, blogging for friends and family every time we, you know, once a month or so, just to say, here's the update. I found it emotionally less exhausting to just sort of write one update that everyone could read than to have to update everyone all the time. And then also, yeah, it really did sort of bring people into our journey and our decision-making process, and particularly our families who, for them, it was kind of hard to wrap their minds around in some cases that this is how we were creating our family. But once we were just, you know, communicating about why we were making decisions that we were making and how the process went, and just answering all the questions, it just became much easier, I think, for them and ultimately for us as well. So recommend openness as a strategy as well.
That sounds great. Well, Emily, thank you so much for sharing your journey with us today. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Absa Talks. I so appreciate it.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It was really nice to talk to you.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me this morning and for sharing your story with us. I'm going to ask if you wouldn't mind to just go ahead and introduce yourself and the other members of your family.
Sure. So my name is Ravi Buck. I'm a Foreign Service officer. Been with the State Department for about 13 years now. I met my husband, Claudio, during my second tour when I was an economics officer at the embassy in Bucharest, Romania. He was originally my dentist, actually. We've been together for 9 years now and married for 7.
Excellent. And so from in your relationship, whether before you were married or maybe right after you got married, did it always seem like kids, a child was in the picture for you all, or did that sort of come along, that idea come along later for you?
That actually came up pretty early in our relationship. I had been in a previous relationship prior, and sort of one of the main sticking points was that my previous partner really had not wanted to have kids at all. So we sort of were drifting, but sort of had always known that I really wanted to be a dad. That had sort of been pretty much as far back as I can remember as a kid. I just thought being a dad was the coolest. When things started getting serious, you know, with Claudia, I would say within that first 3 months phase, we had had discussions about whether or not we wanted to have kids. And when I found out that he was also interested in having kids, and you know, roughly the same number, 2 kids, that sort of helped solidify the relationship, but also helped solidify us on our path. Because I had been preparing pretty much since I joined the Foreign Service, sort of squirreling away money because I knew that surrogacy would not be cheap. I had sort of been building up funds to plan to do a surrogacy. So it had been something that had been on my mind, I guess, you know, that had already been like 4 years into my sort of plan making.
So, and you mentioned surrogacy. It sounds like that was sort of the path you had in mind for growing your family from a even early in your, even before your relationship with Kodo. Is that right?
Yeah, I had an aunt and uncle who had tried to do adoption, and I saw them go through it about 10 years almost, you know, from when I was a young kid to almost a teenager, and just constant ups and downs. I mean, there were times where they literally thought they were going to get a baby and then the mother changed their mind. There was one time where they had a baby and then the mother changed her mind and they had to give up the baby after like a week or two. And so realizing that surrogacy was within reach, you know, it was no longer just sort of a super expensive, only the rich could afford it. The idea that, you know, we would be able to create a child with some of our own characteristics or traits, mm-hmm. but just sort of at the end of the day, this was our baby. And you know, I know some people have had great experiences with adoption, but just watching my aunt and uncle, I just didn't want to go through that process. Right. Not that surrogacy is any less stressful, but, you know, I think that probably tainted my view of adoption.
I can understand that. Well, and so you understood sort of the financial requirements of surrogacy and going through ART procedures for surrogacy. What were your next steps once you all, and I guess, how did you all decide that the time was right for you?
Yeah. So that's a fair question. So, I had, really a great resource for dads who are looking at our, intended parents who would like to become dads, menhavingbabies.org. It's this, group. They also have a Facebook group, but there's a lot of resources there. There's a lot of information, a lot of what to expect, a lot of reviews of IVF clinics and surrogacy agencies. And so that kind of gave us a general ballpark of how much we were sort of expecting it would cost, which was going to be around $100,000, $120,000. After we served together in Beijing, China, And starting around 2018, when I knew we were heading back to the States for a DC tour, we had sort of reached that amount of money in that stock account. the stocks were going up and things were looking pretty good. So we started to cash out the stocks and started reaching out to IVF providers. We also applied for the Gay Parenting Assistance Program through menhavingbabies.org. Where we got some discounts from the IVF and from the surrogacy agency. So that helped put it a little bit more in perspective. So late 2017 is when we selected our IVF clinic and we selected our egg donor. In January of 2018, we flew back to the States. You know, we were visiting family anyways for Christmas. And we went to the IVF clinic and sort of gave our genetic information to the IVF clinic. For embryo creation, which then happened in April of that year. And we had also been in touch with a surrogacy agency. And so we were lined up for our first transfer in July of 2018. And we were back in the state. So one of the things that was important for us was that we would be stateside and be near the surrogate so that we were not sort of in China having to fly back to the States in case if anything, came earlier or there was any other concerns.
Right. And that also then allowed you to be part of the prenatal process and appointments and things like that. What was that? So the first transfer was scheduled for July 2018. How did that go?
So the first transfer was successful, which is not always the case. Mm-hmm. And so we were ecstatic. We were pregnant. We were living in DC. Our surrogate was a lesbian couple living in Pennsylvania. So it was actually very possible for us to drive out and go to some of those prenatal appointments. So things were looking good. I started to reach out to my office and talk about taking, back then there was no parental leave. This was 2018. Right. So I was discussing taking annual leave and LWAP. And then unfortunately in November of that year, we received news that our surrogate had miscarried at about 16 weeks, which was pretty devastating to us. We had waited until the 13th week to announce on Facebook that we were pregnant to our friends and family. And so it was a big gut punch. We were pretty devastated. We had some conversations with the surrogate. We all decided to just take a break for a little bit. We had to recoup some financially just to be able to try again. Once you're pregnant with the surrogate, you start paying her sort of on a weekly basis. Mm-hmm. So, that had accrued some expenses already that we would have to recoup. In more discussions with our surrogate agency, everybody decided that it would be best if we just chose a different surrogate.
Okay.
And so we signed all the paperwork and took out a loan from the TSP to help cover some of the cost differences. We agreed on our new surrogate around Christmas time of 2019. And so our first transfer was going to be March of 2020. I think you can imagine where the story is going. So the surrogate lived in North Carolina and the IVF clinic was in Connecticut. And so the March 31st transfer did not happen because because of COVID.
Yeah.
And then we tried to push again for July of 2020. And that is when New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut had their tri-state restrictions on people from states with high levels of COVID, and North Carolina was a state of high levels of COVID, so we couldn't do that transfer either. And so then we tried again in December of 2020. That time we were able to do the transfer, but unfortunately we weren't pregnant. And so then we tried again in February of 2021. And this time we were pregnant, which was like just great news. It was hard being pregnant during COVID. We had not anticipated, obviously, COVID. And so in our initial contract with the surrogate, we had not discussed vaccines. And so that was a point of contention. We had a disagreement on that. And ultimately, the surrogate actually did get COVID in September. So when there was Delta, luckily, she recovered very quickly. And so we can assume that she probably gave some antibodies to our little baby girl, Sabrina, who was born 2 weeks early. So we were anticipating a November 8th birthday, and she was born October 26th. So my husband and I had about 4 hours to fly from Boston to Raleigh in order to catch the last flight. And so the hospital was able to delay. It was going to be a C-section birth regardless. So they were able to delay the delivery so that we were actually able to be there when she was born. So that was that was great. So
a happy ending amidst, you know, yes. I guess really 3 years, it sounds like, of ups and downs and COVID. I'm glad you all were able to be there. And then just with surrogacy, you'd mentioned some of the challenges family members had had with adoption. Were there any of those complications with surrogacy? Everything was clear that Sabrina was yours, right?
Yes. So that is, our surrogate agency, and I think most of the reputable ones have either a team of lawyers or will hire a lawyer for you. So we did what's called a pre-birth order. And so in North Carolina, we had the lawyers petition to the court explaining that this child, so we did what's called the gestational carrier surrogacy. So the surrogate has no genetic relation to the child. So the egg donor is a separate woman. And then of course it has one of our DNA. So there is no genetic relation to the child. The lawyers petition to the court explained this, state that from the date of birth, this child will be registered under both Claudio and I, that the surrogate has no legal right or claim to this child, that everybody agrees, you know, everybody signed it. It was, notarized. And so on the day of the birth, the hospital was great in North Carolina. Actually, we filled out all the paperwork quite easily. And from the date of the birth, the original birth certificate lists both Claudio and I as parent one and parent two.
Excellent. Excellent. And how has, so you doing the math, but also you shared with me before, Sabrina is 8 months old. How has that, the last 8 months been?
It's been great. Exhausting at the same time. We had lots of parent friends who helped explain what to expect, but you don't know it until you're in it. Really very happy that the State Department now has the 3 months of parental leave. My office was very helpful in making sure that, I had backup and I didn't really check my work email at all those first 3 months. And we were able to find a daycare program to start kicking in pretty much right at the 3 month mark. So
that's amazing.
We have daycare right now, which is great, because even though I work from home, as you can imagine, having an infant at home and trying to work is pretty close to impossible. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that's been great.
That's wonderful. Is there anything, we talked about COVID challenges, and I think some of those are starting to ease now, at least in terms of travel, certainly within the country. But right now, for somebody who is considering surrogacy or IVF, maybe through another means, as part of their family formation, do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, our advice is, as soon as you are financially able to, just really start the process, because you sometimes see the stories where first try leads to a complete birth, 9 months later, and everything was perfect and the journey was super easy. One of the things that we really liked about that menhavingbabies.org Facebook group was when we were sharing our miscarriage story, we heard from other intended parents who had also had just very long journeys. And so if you're ready to be a dad and you guys have decided this and you've agreed on everything else, just go ahead and start the process as much as you can. Typically, the first process that you would need to start if you are looking at that is, reach out to a surrogate agency, put your name down, and then pretty much start as soon as you can with the IVF, because surrogate agencies really are waiting until you have embryos ready before they will match you with somebody, because embryo creation could also take a while. You never know. We were lucky in the sense that our egg donor on the first try was able to produce a pretty large amount of eggs for us, viable eggs. And after our sperm analysis, we were able to sort of go on the first try without having to take any other precautions or sort of preparations. But That is, you should really try to start the IVF process, the clinic embryo creation part first, because it's, you can't really transfer an embryo if you don't have an embryo. So that's the first step that I would recommend people do. And you know, you can freeze those embryos for as long as needed, but that's really the first step you would need to take.
Okay. And one just sort of follow-up question back to I think the something that we discussed very early on. You said you all had, you and your husband had discussed two children. Obviously, your first is only 8 months old. Are you all still looking at another baby in the future?
Oh, we are, yes. So our surrogate has agreed to work with us again, which we're very happy about. And so we are again out. We have the embryos frozen, so we're already ahead on that step. But we're going to start, the idea is to try to start transferring, you know, we're, typically doctors recommend waiting at least roughly a year. So, you know, she was born in October. So we'll probably start the transfer again early spring of next year. And so, yeah, we're hoping to have a second, a boy and a girl. And so, you know, that's also a fun part about IVF or surrogacy. You can choose to know as much or as little as you would like to know. You can know the sex of each embryo, or you can ask them not to tell you. You can choose to know who the genetic father was of each embryo, or you can ask not to know. So really it's, you know, really have those discussions ahead of time. You know, do you want to know who that genetic father is? Do you want to know the sex of the child before you implant? Really, there's a lot of questions that you guys will sort of have to have discussions about. And, you know, there's no right answers. It's really just whatever each couple is comfortable with.
And I think I appreciate you, your suggestion to have those questions early so that you're not maybe, you know, further along in the process saying, oh, well, maybe I want to know, and you're having the discussion that maybe a disagreement at that point. That is something I hadn't considered.
Yes. So thank
you. and anything else you want to share with our listeners before we wrap up?
You know, I mean, it's a great journey. It really is. If you know you want to be a dad, it's super great. And I just think that starting early with the process, you know, is really your best bet, because you might be the very lucky dad who gets your first try and everything works great. But hang in there, you know, eventually you will be a dad, and it's really great that it is within our reach nowadays. You know, I really feel that surrogacy is an option, and it's an option that I think a lot of middle class families can do now. It's no longer prohibitively expensive. But it's something that, you know, I really recommend. You know, I'm glad that we started when we did. But I really think that, you know, if you're sort of thinking, oh, should we wait? Never is a great time. You know, like, never is everything going to be lined up perfectly. Pretty much every parent I've spoken to has said, you know, there's never a good time to be a dad to like a 1 month old. So yes. You might as well just do it whenever you can, you know, because for my personal preference, I think you should start as early as you think is viable for you, because you don't know what delays could happen, and you do need a lot of energy to keep up with these infants. So
that is no joke. That is no joke. So, well, Ravi, thank you very much. I think we'll leave it there for today, but I do want to mention you have agreed to join us for our Ask for Live event on June 30th. So for any of our listeners, if you have questions for Ravi about his experience and his family formation journey, please feel free to join us at 11 a.m. Eastern on June 30th. Check our website, aspa.org/events, for more information. Ravi, thank you so much.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to all of our guests for joining us for this episode and for sharing their stories with us. At this time, the Foreign Service Benefit Plan does not offer coverage for IVF, IUI, or other ART procedures. However, we do offer a partnership through Aetna with the Institutes of Excellence in Fertility Providers. Through that, FSBP members can access infertility providers with proven outcomes through Aetna's Institutes of Excellence in Fertility Network. For more information and to learn more, visit www.etnainfertilitycare.com. We also offer, through our ancillary insurance partnerships, certain partnerships with legal firms throughout the Washington, D.C. area. For more information on those partnerships, if you're considering adoption or have legal needs of others kinds, please visit www.afspa.org/AIP and look for the professional services and legal services tabs. This has been AFSPA Talks, a production of the American Foreign Service Protective Association. All information offered in this podcast is meant to be educational. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily represent AFSPA. Should there be any discrepancy between information offered in this podcast and official plan documents for the Foreign Service Benefit Plan or other products offered by AFSPA, the policy provisions will prevail. Thank you for listening, and be sure to subscribe to AFSPA Talks to catch our next episode, and visit afspa.org/events to see more of our upcoming events, including AFSPA Live. Please rate and review us on your favorite podcast app and share feedback with us on Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, looking for @AFSPA Cares.